that's what we're going to have to do is take it to the street. Folks, I'm Maggie DeHaan. You're listening to the Maggie DeHaan Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. A couple of severe weather updates before we bring on our next guest. We are getting reports from Madison and Sun Prairie that there is indeed pea-sized hail. And in the Portage area, it is almost dark as night. Please be very, very careful out there. In Wisconsin Rapids, we've got a severe thunderstorm warning and tornado watches right now. We've been hearing sirens throughout the city in Wisconsin Rapids. Please, 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 everyone, keep tuned here. We'll keep bringing you the weather updates. Be safe out there. Rather safe than sorry. Folks, again, welcome back. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie DeHaan. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. We got a fine guest from the Center for American Progress Action Fund joining us this afternoon. Her name is Sarah Partridge. She's the Associate Director of Higher Education Policy at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Jacob, if you can add her to the studio, that would be wonderful. Welcome, Sarah. It's so great to have you with us.
Hi, Maggie. Great to be here.
Let's just start right out. You have a PhD, you are a researcher, and you look at affordability and equity in higher education. So I wanted to start with a level set. Why the hell is university and college education so damnedly expensive these days? When I talk to folks that are a couple generations younger than me, older than myself, including my parents, folks of my parents' generation, my dad was able to self-finance and work a spare job and pay for all of his university education on his own. That is non-existent today. The bills are enormous. What's going on? Why is it so expensive?
That's a great question. And there are a couple factors to keep in mind. One is on the cost side. So costs have risen over time, including the input costs that go into college, such as faculty salaries, administration salaries, everything that goes into operating a college or university. Alongside that, we've also seen some disinvestment in higher education from the federal and state government in different ways. So there are ways that has kind of created a storm to have us rely more on student loan debt and put the burden more on individuals to finance their higher education than previous generations did.
Yeah, putting it out of reach for many. I know here in Wisconsin, we had been able to support our university system for so many decades, keeping it well in the, or at least within the affordability range for working people. Republicans in this state have been consistently chipping away at that funding level for decades now, placing many of our university system schools outside of affordability range for many of the working families here in Wisconsin. This is part of really a broader attack on education writ large, but especially the higher education system here in this country from Republicans. We're looking at a bill coming through the House, right, that's going to gut Medicaid and SNAP for tens of millions of Americans while providing the single largest tax cut in American history to the ultra wealthy and mega corporations. This bill would dramatically alter the education sector and cut more than $350 billion in federal investments that make higher education even arguably accessible, though it is still such a reach for so many, especially attacking the Pell Grant program, which if you talk to first-gen college graduates, whether it is Congresswoman Gwen Moore here in the state of Wisconsin or others, that seems to be at risk. Where are we right now? Is that a done deal? Are there things that our listeners can do to stop the gutting of the Pell Grant program and other federal programs that help make university education maybe even an option for some?
That's right, Maggie. Thank you so much for outlining all of that. That's exactly right. Right now, there is a bill under consideration in the House, which can be passed on a party line vote through the budget reconciliation process. So through this process, the legislation is meant to be budgetary, focused on dollars and cents, and less focused on policy. And that allows it to bypass the filibuster in the Senate. So right now, it is possible that it could be going to the floor for a vote as soon as next week. And then the Senate will turn to it and determine what their version of the bill looks like. And right now it touches a lot. It cuts. It takes a sledgehammer to Medicaid, to nutrition assistance in the form of SNAP, and to all of these foundational investments in higher education that make it affordable for people from all backgrounds. And we know that in so many ways, higher education really does remain a pathway to the middle class, even given the student loan debt that many students have to take out. The earnings premium that most people receive from an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, really gives them access to a wide range of great careers. So we really want to make sure that that remains accessible to everyone who wants it. And this bill, this House Republican budget reconciliation bill, would do exactly the opposite. It would cut billions from several different programs that make it possible for people to attend college, and that includes the Pell Grant program. So the Pell Grant is the foundational investment in need-based federal financial aid. 92% of students who receive a Pell Grant come from families that earn under $60,000 per year, and the Pell Grant has really not kept pace with the rising cost of college over the decades. So it used to cover much more of a tuition than it does today. So this legislation would further hammer away at that, and it does it in a kind of back-end way of changing eligibility requirements. So it changes the definition of full-time from 12 credits per semester to 15 credits per semester. And it also prevents people who are enrolled less than half-time from receiving Pell Grants. So that would disproportionately impact community college students. And we know that people who are enrolled less than half-time are more likely to work.
Right. I was just going to say, listen, if you're someone who's applying for a Pell Grant, the challenge is you are most likely having to work while you are pursuing your degree, which is why people would have 12 credits as opposed to 15.
Yes.
15 is considered to be a full-time student, slightly under that at 12. That's what I knew a lot of my friends when I was in college that had to work because their parents couldn't afford a $50,000 cash payment for tuition, books, and room and board. They were working because they had to, and it was incredibly difficult for them to maintain a 15 or 18 credit load. I know that. I worked in the cafeteria of the dorm I lived in, which, very humbling experience, serving your own fellow dorm mates in the caf line. I want to reemphasize how impactful the Pell Grant program is. Do you have some of the statistics, Sarah, on how many people have been lifted into higher education by the Pell Grant, how long it's been around, how impactful it is? Again, this is a needs-based federal, basically grant program that helps people access higher education. And here's my big philosophical question, and then you can go at it, Sarah, however you would like. I have lived in Denmark. I studied abroad when I was at university. Anyone who is able to get into a program attended that program. You didn't need to have come from a family with huge resources in order to access the higher education that you were qualified to pursue. It was, in a word, much more meritocratic. If you could address that and how many more anti-meritocratic obstacles would be in the way of people, that we would be losing so many incredible opportunities to develop the superpowers, the super brains of the next generation if this proposal goes through.
Absolutely. You're so right. And well, in the most recent award year, almost 7 million undergraduate students received Pell Grants, about 6.8 million. And this legislation would affect two out of three of them. So it would affect the majority. So an estimated 4.4 million would either lose their Pell Grant funding entirely or see it reduced on average about 20%. So, and in Wisconsin, that would be about 17,000 people would lose all of their Pell Grant funding, and about 37,000 students would have their Pell Grant funding reduced. So they would be in this situation where they would have to say, okay, do I take on more courses? And then if they're working, then they have to take on fewer hours, so it costs them money. Or maybe they take on more courses, or maybe they take on more debt in order to
I was
to
just
going to
say, put that tuition bill on the old credit card, which is a wonderful way to set yourself about 10 steps behind before you even get, before the starting bell goes off. The trickle down here, and I hate using that term because wealth doesn't trickle down, it always trickles up. But in this case, one of the trickle down or domino impacts here, if you think, ladies and gentlemen, if you've been worried about the University of Wisconsin's university system and the fact that we have had to close some of our smaller and satellite campuses because of lower enrollment, we're already facing what I'm going to call the higher education demographic crunch of a couple of generations. There's simply going to be fewer people in the age range of 18 to 28, 29, 30, depending on which analysis you're looking at in the coming decade. What this will always also do is if you have fewer Pell Grant recipients, you will have lower enrollments by definition, which will mean fewer tuition dollars coming into public university systems like the University of Wisconsin, which could pose existential threats to some of our smaller campuses. Or am I reading the dominoes wrong there, Sarah?
No, that's absolutely correct. And there are many ways that this legislation would squeeze states and would squeeze public higher education in particular. Medicaid cuts, SNAP cuts. Historically, when states our budgets are squeezed, some of those cuts have come from higher education. We saw that in the Great Recession, and that is a big reason why student debt skyrocketed around that time in the early 2010s. So it's absolute. There are so many ways that this bill would raise costs for students, would raise costs for states, and put them in a really challenging budgetary position. So it's imperative that anyone who cares about public higher education, anyone who's a student, anyone who cares about broad-based access to higher education, call your representatives, tell them you do not support this reconciliation bill, tell them, you know, it would take literally food out of people's mouths and healthcare away and their access to education away.
If they want to tell you that they believe in meritocracy, why in the hell would they gut the Pell Grant program? Right. It is completely hypocritical. 16,000 Wisconsinites' opportunity to pursue the education that they are qualified to pursue is at risk, along with an additional 37,000 who may face reduced Pell Grant funding, a generation potentially left behind, not because they're unable, but because they simply can't afford it. Call your reps and say, no way. We're going to take care of a few brief messages. We'll come right back on the other side with Jeremy Janine. We'll see what's going on in the Zeidler building here in the city of Milwaukee. Keep it locked. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Thank you.